Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. The opioid crisis that is sweeping the nation is being fought on many different levels. State-funded Drug-Free Workplace PA's goal is to educate employers and employees about the dangers of substance abuse in the workplace. To tell us more about it today is Gina Reardon, the program supervisor for Drug-Free Workplace PA. Ms. Reardon, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
If you have a question or a comment, 1-800-729-7532 or send an email to smarttalk@WITF.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Why is there a need for an agency, an organization like Drug-Free Workplace PA?
Well, we have 6.4 million PA citizens that are employed. And so that in itself just goes to show you that that's a perfect audience and a venue in which that we can assist them in putting drug-free workplace policies in place, as well as provide substance use disorder education. We know for a fact that about over 70% of employees have substance use disorders, are employed by full-time or part-time. So again, they are in the workplace.
I guess what I'm also looking for is whether your organization, your agency, was developed because the opioid crisis. I mean, is it kind of, are you there because this has been happening?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it depends, you know, I travel all around the state, talk to, you know, a lot of employers. I was just up in Elk County yesterday, a small manufacturer, and there are two substances that they are most challenged with, is opioids and alcohol, when it comes to job performance. And they have a policy that they do immediate termination. But again, the opioid is definitely at the top of the list when it comes to the substance use.
So what does your organization do?
We assist employers with their policy development. In many cases, there are organizations that don't have drug-free workplace policies in place. So we encourage them to go online. We have a policy builder, very easy tool that they can go online and complete and have a 6-page policy in place in a matter of less than a half an hour. We also take a look maybe at their existing policy and make some suggestions on how they can enhance it. The other areas, we go into the workplace and we provide supervisor and employee education. So we make sure that the supervisors have and employees have a full understanding of what is addiction. Then we educate them on the different drug categories and signs and symptoms, which is very important, obviously, for supervisors to be able to identify behaviors. The employee side, then we hone in on the family and how does it impact the family. So really, tools, resources, policy development, and training. That's what we do.
So these policies, what do they look like?
They incorporate, specific the types of drug testing that perhaps they would do, pre-employment, post-employment, reasonable suspicion, you know, that type of thing. They identify about 10 different areas, you know, of policy development. Yeah.
Most policies, you mentioned the one in Elk County yesterday that you worked with. Do most policies include termination if someone fails a drug test or is, has a substance problem?
It really depends on the environment. I definitely have found, you know, obviously with manufacturers that have high safety issues, yes. In this case, that was the case because, again, there was a lot of high safety issues. We are into employers that they do have assignment agreements and those types of things that allow employees to get treatment and then they're able to then re-enter, you know, the workplace. Again, it has a lot to do with what the employer chooses.
I know that, as you just described, you work with both employers and employees, but who are you there for?
Really, for both. I mean, it is the epidemic is just so severe. You know, obviously we are there for the employer, making sure that their employees are safe and it's a safe environment. But then too, from an employee perspective, you know, this is a community issue. You know, I mean, the deaths are huge. I mean, if you take a look at the staggering numbers of, you know, 2016, we're looking at over 65,000 individuals that are died, you know, of overdose. I mean, those numbers are sheer numbers alone. And so, you know, the workplace is an area that, if you really think about it, how much time do we spend in our workplace? I mean, we spend so much time in our workplace. Not more than a few months ago, you know, I had an incident to where that there was an individual that they were using alcohol, was definitely impacting. But when we went in and was able to educate the employees actually came alongside of that particular employee. It was a peer-to-peer conversation that they had, and the employer didn't even end up having to address it because the employees did. So education is power.
But when you say the employees addressed it, how?
Now, they came alongside of that individual and said, you know, look, there is definitely an issue. It's impacting your performance, your work, and you need help. And then that individual went and got help.
Was it a safety issue as well?
In that particular case, it was not. It was really more work performance. You know, it was more of that office environment. But, you know, we know that early intervention with addiction is, you know, the key. That is the ultimate goal, obviously, of prevention and education.
Alcohol abuse is nothing new. I mean, this has been going on for a long, long time, and it has had a major impact over the years on employee performance, work that an employer gets out of an employee. So alcohol is not new. But let me switch to opioids right now. Mm-hmm. What are you seeing across the state? I mean, you mentioned the number of overdose deaths, and we hear about it every day in the media, because it has reached epidemic stage where there are so many people that are affected or impacted by it. So how do you actually see it? I mean, can you tell that this has reached crisis stage by the sheer number of employers, employees that you hear from that need help?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it is typically, you know, we call it like kind of the drug of choice in what they see, just definitely from a majority perspective, you know, in the workplace. Now, I would say a little bit more perhaps in manufacturing versus maybe a nonprofit or an office environment. But we know from an addiction perspective, you know, we know the magnitude of the drug that we're talking about and then the sheer addiction. And that is something, too, that we talk about in our training. You know, I've been in a supervisor capacity for over 20 years. And I must say that when early on in my career, you know, 10 years ago, I didn't fully understand addiction. So when I had an employee that I was working with, you know, I didn't get it. I couldn't understand why they couldn't stop, knowing that it was actually impacting, you know, not only their work performance, but potentially they could lose their job. But again, fast forward now, you know, 20 years plus, I have a full understanding of what addiction is. And again, the magnitude of the substance that we're talking about with opioids and what it does to the brain and how it hijacks the brain, that's huge. And so, again, it's going to take, you know, family, community, you know, and the workplace to come alongside of these individuals and hold them accountable for getting help.
That experience with an employee that you mentioned, that had a great impact on you, didn't it?
Oh, it did. Oh, very much so. And I've worked with employers that have had drug-free workplace policies in place, and I have worked with ones that have not. And from a supervisor perspective, you know, having that policy, being able to walk through that policy and fully understand that policy and be able to implement that versus not having anything in place is huge. I'm still quite surprised as I travel around and speak of how many employers don't have policies in place. You know, again, I think in this day and age, it's crazy.
Why don't they have policies?
I think that they don't think, oh, it's not necessarily happening in my workplace. You know, I will tell you, a lot of calls that we do get is based on an incident. You know, it's kind of like one of those things, well, I'm not going to deal with it, you know, until they actually have an incident. And then once they do have an incident, the reality is there and they recognize, we need to definitely, address this. And one of my favorite things of going out and just working with employers and employees is helping that supervisor really fully understand, the signs and symptoms. What are the signs and symptoms, of addiction, how to properly document all of that information, and then, again, step by step, what they need to do. I've just had so many employers, compliment and say thank you. We've been able to assist over 1,000 employers across PA, with this process.
You're in a good position to get a good read on what's happening across the state.
Mm-hmm.
When you're talking about the opioid crisis, there is an employer, an employee that has a substance problem. Alcohol aside, let's just talk about mm-hmm. opioids.
Sure.
Mostly painkillers, mostly heroin, what?
It's a combination of both. I can't say it's really one or the other. It is definitely a combination of both. I will say that I don't think a lot of employers do understand the magnitude of that addiction and sometimes where it can come from with prescriptions. So I would say probably more the employers are more familiar with just that straight, heroin use or, that addiction versus that correlation to, an employee that is prescribed, something, and then in turn it can, move into addiction. That correlation is still not necessarily there with employers.
How does alcohol measure up against the opioids?
It is still the top. I think it's because it's so socially accepted, and, we really don't, we don't hone into it as much as, we should, to be honest with you. But I just had seen a more recent statistic about 40% of the beds in hospitals is a direct correlation, they do believe, of just the alcoholism. And so, again, we know what kind of impact, that even alcoholism is having in our society. But again, it's socially accepted.
I'm jumping around a little bit.
That's
on you.
Okay.
You mentioned you were in Elk County yesterday. Here in South Central Pennsylvania, the opioid crisis has been well documented. We have had just too many overdose deaths in York County, Lancaster County, all over the area. A small rural county like Elk County, I'm curious as to what kind of problem they have.
That's big. It's definitely, the magnitude is huge. Also out in that kind of that Pittsburgh range, also alongside of the Ohio line, that is definitely, where we're seeing the peaks, of the opioid epidemic and overdose. And again, that's that direct correlation to kind of the rural, if you take a look at the trends, they definitely, reflect that the drugs are definitely there. I was at a nonprofit fundraiser last week, and one of the things that I was just blown away was a drug cartel map and, where those drug cartels and those cells are placed and how they are placed throughout, our state. And it's just strategic.
Like where?
It's very, well, just in the northern regions and the more rural areas. We have to remember this is a business. It's very sad. It is taking lives. It is impacting, and they are customers. And, needless to say, I'm very passionate about this. I personally live it. We have 5 children, and we do have one of our children that is currently in recovery. And so, I kind of wear 2 hats. I have that passion about it. I understand how quickly, it can ramp up into addiction and the importance of recovery and getting that early treatment. But then also, too, I wear that hat as being a supervisor for years.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest during this portion of the program is Gina Reardon, the program supervisor for Drug-Free Workplace PA, talking about the opioid crisis and her work, the organization's work, working with employers, working with employees to make the workplace safer and to help a lot of people out there. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. We've talked about the drug-free workplace PA and being state-funded. Something that's very important is that your services, this is free to the public. This
is
free to an employer. Tell me how it works.
Yes, the free is the best part, which when I started with this organization, again, I was kind of blown away because being in senior management for years, you know, I recognized what a lot of employers, you know, pay for a service like this. And I can't say enough and thank, obviously, the state enough for supporting, you know, prevention and education, because, again, it's just absolutely critical, particularly for those small to medium-sized organizations, you know, that cannot afford, you know, this type of policy development and this type of training. So basically, you know, we get referrals many different ways. Sometimes it's phone calls, you know, a lot of times it is word of mouth, and an organization will call us, and initially when we determine if in fact they have a policy, if they do have a policy, we review it. We may make some suggestions on enhancement, on how to enhance it, and then, you know, we move into education. We go ahead and schedule a training. A supervisor training is normally where we start, and we walk through what is addiction. We make sure that the actual supervisors have an understanding of what is addiction. Then we talk about drug categories. Then we go into, you know, reasonable suspicion as what, again, what so supervisors typically have to deal with. All the other drug testing is normally handled by HR, but reasonable suspicion is what supervisors typically are responsible for. So that is the area in which I would say that they need more training and maybe are more just uncomfortable with that area.
That would seem to be very uncomfortable to confront an employee saying that we think you have a problem.
Yes. So we have gone to extent to have tools, we have checklists, we have scripts, and in many cases we do literally like one-on-one scenarios. We do role playing, and you know, in the training, which again, you know, really assists the supervisor. And so when they walk away, you know, again, they have a full understanding of that. Then we go back in and then we train then the employee. And that is the key, is making sure that that, you know, employee too has an understanding of the drug policy. Again, we go through a little bit of signs and symptoms again to kind of empower them from a community perspective. Or in some cases, and a much higher percentage than I think most employers recognize, they may be dealing with this at home. You know, they may have a family member that, you know, is being impacted. So, you know, what are the signs and symptoms? You know, how can they establish perhaps boundaries if they have a family member? And then also how, you know, how exactly can they get help? I should take this opportunity too to just plug that we have, you know, a whole side too that we do family education. And so we not only do workplace education, but we also do family education. So if you have a church, you have a school district, you know, you have really any nonprofit organization in your community that you feel that could benefit from substance use disorder education, we you know, come to you. All of our travel, our overnight expense and hotel, all of that is covered by the grant. And so, you know, whatever we can do to educate is the key.
The grant comes through the Pennsylvania Commission on Crime and Delinquency. Why is this a good idea, or I should say, why is this a good use, a wise use of taxpayer dollars? How do the taxpayers benefit from this?
Well, we know that education and prevention is key. And just the sheer fact that the amount of employers that I am out talking to, you know, and they don't have an understanding. A lot of those supervisors have minimal understanding, you know, of what is addiction and what is the signs and symptoms. And so, you know, just absolutely critical that we get the word out, and people, again, have a better understanding of what a substance use disorder is, how to handle it, and how to get people help.
We have a couple of email questions questions here. The opioid crisis has highlighted so many sad stories and outcomes for families and employees. Are there success stories?
Absolutely. I always put that at the end of every presentation because, again, we have, you know, we're listening to so much negative, you know, on the TV and the media, and recovery does occur. You know, our state grant is actually managed by Gaudenzia, which is the largest drug and alcohol organization in the three-state area. And, you know, we have well over 1,000 employees, and many of those individuals, you know, are currently in recovery. And that is, again, very common in the treatment industry, that you have individuals that are working in that industry that are in recovery. And absolutely, recovery does happen. Recovery is definitely different for everyone. It looks different. Relapse does occur. You know, on average, it's, you know, potentially 4 to 5 times that an individual may relapse before they are actually able to stay clean. But the goal to all of this is that consistently and that continued effort to help them, because, again, it is a disease.
Another question from a listener: has medical marijuana legalization or the legalization of recreational marijuana in other states had any impact on the workforce in Pennsylvania?
Well, yes, we actually do have a actual training that is very specific to medical marijuana. And I won't get into a lot of detail this morning, but I do encourage you that if, in fact, you know, you would like to learn more about medical marijuana, we have about an hour presentation. We do webinars, actually, for labor and industry. We do 4 webinars a month for labor and industry. And the medical marijuana was one of the topics that, you know, we were asked to cover along with some other topic areas. So, yes, it has. Things are still rolling out. You know, the dispensaries really just started opening in February. So, you know, again, employers are still trying to fully understand, you know, what actually occurs and legally what goes on with medical marijuana. But yes, we can definitely address that.
We only have a minute or so left. I want to thank you very much for being with us today. For those employers out there that would like to have you come out and maybe help them with their policy or talk to the company or the employer, how can they do that? How can they? What are some of the ways that they can reach you?
They actually can give us a call at 717-454-3100. That line again is confidential. One of the other things I should mention is we do assist, you know, even families if they have loved ones and they just want to talk. Again, that is definitely all confidential. And then also too at www.drugfreeworkplacepa.org is also our website, and I do encourage you to go online, take a look at that. We do have online trainings too. And we do local education. We currently are doing something in the Mechanicsburg area at the Upper Allen Township on April 9th, and I wanted to give that a plug. We have assisted that community. They have teen suicide and self-harm, and they're talking about substance use disorder. And I do encourage anyone out there that wants to learn more about that topic and how that's a direct correlation to join us again at the Upper Allen Township building on 6:30 on Monday.
Gina Reardon is the program supervisor for Drug-Free Workplace PA. Ms. Reardon, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
And obviously, the opioid crisis is something that we will continue to follow here on WITF on Smart Talk, but WITF overall, and try to provide as much information as we can about this ongoing crisis. Want to mentioned a couple things here. First of all, if you missed our conversation, if you're tuning in late and you want to hear the whole conversation, there are other ways to do that. You can hear it again online at WITF.org/smarttalk. Smart Talk is also available as a podcast. Listen when you're away from your radio using iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you find podcasts. You're listening to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, and we're going to switch gears now and go to something that is totally different right now. The word geography is Greek and originally meant writing about the earth. For many of us, geography was finding places on a map. That definition is still relevant, but it also encompasses learning about other people and cultures today. Unfortunately, geography is not a priority in many schools, and as a result, American students often test poorly in geography. But not the students who will be participants in tomorrow's Pennsylvania State Geography Bee, sponsored by National Geographic. It will be held at the State Museum in Harrisburg. To discuss geography education and the Geography Bee is Daryl Winter. He's co-coordinator for the Pennsylvania State Geography Bee and coordinator for this year's Geo Challenge. He's also a professor of geography at Bloomsburg University. Dr. Winter, thank you very much for being with us today.
And thank you for letting me be here.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. And I should let everyone know that coming up in a few minutes, Dr. Winter is going to have some questions for WITF's multimedia news director, Tim Lambert, WITF Radio PA news director, Brad Crispin. If you're familiar with our spelling bee, this is our first attempt at geography, so we'll be doing that in a few minutes. But first, I wanted to talk, Dr. Winter, about geography education. Let's talk a little bit about the Geography Bee. And I should mention that for the past 2 years, and I will be doing it again, moderating the final round, the championship round of the Geography Bee, and these young people are just, they are so impressive with their knowledge of geography. They are not the students we're talking about that are not getting a good geography education. So talk a little bit about the Bee at the State Museum. If someone wanted to attend or participate, what could they expect?
Well, the Bee will be held on Friday, tomorrow. It starts around 10 o'clock. They'll have a giant traveling map of Pennsylvania will be on display. And then there'll be some other things going on. The Geo Challenge is going on tomorrow, which will start at 9 o'clock, which is actually separate from the Bee. But it will be students presenting their projects on how to improve migration for some species that's facing a challenge. So that'll be open. Anyone who wants to come is welcome to come and see the teams compete. But the Bee itself will get off, I think around noon is sort of the opening ceremony, and they'll welcome all the students in, sort of let everyone settle in. And Nat Geo is going to be there, National Geographic Society. They're going to have a little presentation to start things off and sort of welcome everyone to geography.
What you just mentioned, though, that the Geo Challenge and species and ways to help the species migrate, that's a perfect example of how geography is not just pointing out places on a map. What is geography overall today?
Well, that's kind of one of the issues. For a lot of people, geography is pointing places on a map. It's basically rote memorization of things. And I always tell my students that geography is a methodology. It's a way of doing things. You kind of think of it like math. When you start off in mathematics, you learn your numbers, but you don't really stay there. You don't just walk around saying 2 and 10. You go forward to arithmetic, to algebra, to other formats. And it's while that's going, you know, that process is how then we end up using math to build buildings, to make roads, to, you know, figure out square footage when you want to put flooring in your car, your house. And geography is the same thing. We take the time to learn capitals and rivers and things like that. But then it's also about trying to use those skills in how can we fix problems? So infrastructure, how do we create better roads that are shorter distances between places, or how do we get around areas that may have environmental impacts if you build a road through them that could be devastating? What happens when you do build something that's going to cut off a migration path for a species? Are they going to find a new way around it, or could it decimate the species? If they find a way around it, will it be through some place you don't want them to go, like a town, where now a city and individuals have to deal with this new animal coming through or this new insect? So geography has a lot of practical applications from environmental standpoints, from business standpoints, and logistic standpoints. A lot of our graduates with geographic information systems end up working for companies that are trying to improve just their logistics and how they can get product to people faster, easier, and less expensive.
Here at WITF, and being an affiliate of NPR, one of the things that we pride ourselves on is providing news from around the world. We know that we live in a world today that what's happening in Afghanistan, what's happening in Asia, anywhere in Asia, Africa, can have an impact on people here in Pennsylvania. It's more than just, again, pointing to places on a map. Geography is also understanding cultures, understanding people. Why is that? Explain why that is so important.
Well, from a cultural standpoint, how you think about something is going to impact how you view it. To give a historic concept, I always studied World War II and I was interested in it. In the western part of that war, when you talk about the nations from Europe, surrender was an acceptable thing to do. It was part of the culture that if you were outmanned, outgunned, and you had no hope of winning, to surrender to the enemy was an acceptable
unless
option.
Unless you were a Nazi.
But even some of them by the end of the war were giving up when they realized it was over. Whereas in Japan, their culture had been taught from the beginning that surrender was dishonor, not just for you, but for your entire family. So a Japanese soldier who was captured alive brought dishonor to everyone in his family, his mother, his father, his brothers, all of them. So that led, when we went to fight in that part of the war, Americans often said, well, why aren't they giving up? They're outgunned. I mean, Japanese soldiers would literally charge machine guns with swords or with shovels with no hope of winning simply so they could be killed so they wouldn't dishonor their families. And there were a lot of American soldiers who were killed, especially early in the war, because they assumed the Japanese were going to give up, that a guy who was lying wounded on the battlefield was out of the battle, whereas they would pull a grenade and blow up the medic who tried to help them because they would rather be dead. And that kind of cultural thing, to understand that is important. And that's still in our world today. We look at North Korea and, you know, their desperate need for nuclear weapons. For a country that small who, let's face it, even with nuclear weapons, they're not going to take over the world. Why do they need that? There's something culturally there going on within their government, within their mindset that says we need to be a major player on the world stage and this is how to do it.
And that's part of geography education?
It is. We study that political geography, looking at different interactions between governments and countries, looking at it historically as to where these things developed from, why there is a North and South Korea as opposed to just one Korean nation. There's a lot of subfields to geography, and it's, like I said, it's more of a methodology. How do you look at a problem as opposed to just memorizing where it is?
You know, I really hate repeating those surveys that show that American students do not fare well in, you know, the topics that they don't do well in. But geography, consistently, only about a quarter of American students are proficient in world geography. And that has been consistent over the years. Part of that is because there is not a real emphasis on geography in K through 12. Where is the challenge there? What's happening that American students are not doing as well as they should?
I think a lot of it comes from schools having a lot of other things they have to do. We push mathematics, we push reading, we're pushing literacy, and for obvious reasons, right? If you can't read, if you can't do math, you're in trouble in the rest of your world. Because we're so bent on certain things, and because our funding a lot of times is limited because teachers are overwhelmed with the number of students in classrooms, and when you look at, you know, nationally, any given school, yes, there are some schools that are wonderful for teaching, you know, geography and for other things. But we've kind of pushed those certain blocks ahead where we think this is where the jobs will be. This is the job skills you need. And so that becomes the emphasis, and then things like social studies in general, where we're studying government or law or geography, we sort of lump them together and say, well, we'll get to that, and we will put that in where we can. And for a lot of schools, it just becomes that decision. You know, we're being tested on in the standards on math, or there's a national standard.
Well,
we have to
testing
reach
to. Is a big thing, yeah.
Yeah, but if geography is not on that, it's, well, if we're going to be tested in math and not in geography in order for our funding, we'll have to go with what we're being tested on.
Ideally, what would a geography curriculum look like in K through 12?
If I had my way.
That's what I'm looking for, if you had your way.
I guess if I was president. I would want to see geography taught like math is, that you would start with every day from K through 12, developing first just the understanding of where places are, you know, what the continents are, what the oceans are, working through different cities and states and countries and all that, but then getting into more of the meat of it and understanding how interactions happen, talking about logistics by the time they're in high school, talking about international politics and cultural exchanges and things. and slowly building that so that by the time they're reaching college, they're ready for the deeper questions and saying, all right, what do we do now when we're looking at an international politics? I was listening this morning, President Trump is sending troops to the border of Mexico. Let's put that to a question and say, what is that going to implicate? What are going to be the long-term ramifications of having our physical border to the south and our neighbor? How is this going to interact between us culturally, economically, and into the future? And those are the questions that we'd want our students to be able to answer coming out so that they're not just saying, where is the Mexican border, as opposed to, oh, well, this is going to be the long term of this. We need to readjust our policy.
It almost sounds like what you're describing with geography is part of civics education.
It would be, yeah. And that's part of where it often falls is in that social studies, civics, government. And it would work in that curriculum. I think it's just that too often it gets pigeonholed as map skills or learn the capitals, learn the states. And it doesn't really become a what can this be used to do later on. Once you know where all these things are, what can we be made to do?
Quick question for you. Do you have a physical map in your car? Do you use GPS?
We have some physical maps. I do not have a GPS unit. I've never really liked them. I use my head more than anything.
Your wife criticize you when you look at the map like mine does?
No, she usually uses the map and
she's a coordinator, geography.
Yeah.
So yeah, maybe that's the bad question for you. But mine, I open the map and she's, what are you doing? You have a GPS. We'll talk. We're going to have some fun with this coming up in just a moment with the first ever Smart Talk at Geography B. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest during this portion of the program is Daryl Wenner, co-coordinator for the Pennsylvania State Geography Bee and coordinator for this year's Geo Challenge. He's also a professor of geography at Bloomsburg University. Longtime listeners to Smart Talk have probably heard our Smart Talk Spelling Bee. Well, today we're having our first ever Smart Talk Geography Bee, and we're joined by WITF's Multimedia News Director Tim Lambert and WITF's Radio Pennsylvania News Director Brad Christman. Gentlemen, welcome to the show to show off what you know in the area of geography.
Well, thank you, Scott.
Hold on just a second.
There you go. Thank you, Scott. It's good to be here. I am very sorry I missed the spelling bee this year, but you scheduled it on my birthday and I was out of town, and also I really didn't want to do it.
Well, Tim was a little reluctant to show his geography skills.
Yeah, well, as my spelling skills have shown, this could be a disastrous event.
But Tim has the advantage. He's traveled abroad much more than I have because he gets about 42 weeks of vacation a year. So
that's the morning pay.
So, Dr. Wenner, these questions that you've come up with, they actually come from or are similar to questions that the students will be asked?
Yes. The questions are from NGS's website that they have for students to just go on and practice and see. Anyone can go on and check these out.
Oh, see, if I would have
known that. I wish I had known that ahead of time.
You should have told us that.
Well, that's why I did.
Anyway, by the way, it's before rigged. We even get started here, the students in this the Geography B are what age group?
They can be anywhere from 3rd to 8th grade.
Okay.
Oh, this
so
is
guys,
not going to be pretty.
This is what we're dealing with, 3rd to 8th graders, and they just do an amazing job. All right.
Scott goes first.
Scott
goes
first.
Brad goes second.
Go ahead.
Are these multiple choice?
Well, in the B, typically the way it works is the first few rounds will be multiple choice, where you'll get two or three answers for options, and then the last few rounds are just you have to know the answer on your own.
Okay. I like the multiple choice.
Yeah, I do too.
All right, go ahead.
So our first round here, preliminary, is just basic U.S. geography.
Oh, okay.
So for Scott, which present-day state was part of the Louisiana Purchase, Nebraska or Oregon?
See, this is a trick question. Nebraska.
That is correct.
Okay. Now, guys, he's keeping track, but let's keep track.
Right,
keep
going.
Go ahead, Brad.
So for Brad, which state has two panhandles, Colorado or West Virginia?
That would be... Well, Colorado is just a rectangle, so it would be West Virginia.
That is correct.
That's easy.
Yeah.
And for Tim, Lake Superior borders Michigan, Minnesota, and which other state? Missouri or Wisconsin?
Wisconsin.
That is correct.
Yes. I've gotten one right, which is more than I've done in spelling for 5 years.
Tied up. All right, so now this round is going to be about some geo-extremes. We're going to look at some of the largest areas or most populated. So, for Scott. Which country is Africa's largest by area? Algeria or South Sudan?
South Sudan.
That is incorrect. Algeria is larger.
Really? I knew that.
No, you didn't. Hindsight's 2020. Really?
Yep. Okay. For Brad.
Okay. Yes.
Which country is the least densely populated country in the world? Australia or Mongolia?
I am going to go with Australia.
No, Mongolia is the correct.
Wow.
It's Mongolia.
Least densely populated.
Least densely.
As in per...
Well, I understand.
Tim, your question.
Genghis Khan must have just killed too many people.
That's probably what happens.
See, yep. There's your history lesson with geography.
That's why a wide-ranging knowledge is good. Which country is Africa's most populous country? Egypt or Nigeria?
Egypt.
Nope, Nigeria.
Wow.
Well, you can tell these questions are getting tougher.
And it remains a first place tie.
Everyone is in first place. We should all be. Okay, so for this round, there'll be no guess or no multiple choice. It's just choice. Your
okay.
choice.
There, all
so.
Right.
This is a border blitz. What, Scott, what Nordic country has the longest border with Russia?
Norway.
No, Finland.
Really?
Yes.
See, okay, I should stop saying that like
I'm surprised. If you'd watched Occupy on Netflix, you'd have known that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have Netflix, what? So... but
it's $9 a month.
So think about this. So, well, I don't watch a lot of television, Tim. I'm actually listening to radio and preparing for the show. But anyway, oh Finland... now, see, that's there is something that... think about it. As small as Finland is...
He's playing for the tie right now.
He is. Yeah, he is. He's running the clock right now. This is a four-corner defense.
No, I'm just saying that Finland is so small, you never would have thought that. So, okay. All right.
Is there a shot clock in this that I should
have?
There should be for Scott. Yeah.
So, Brad, the Sulu Sea separates which island country from Malaysia?
You know, this is how dumb I am. When he said Sulu, I instantly went to Star Trek. I'm going to say... well... I was going to say Indonesia, but that's probably not right.
That isn't correct. Philippines.
Philippines.
Is the correct answer.
Where is the Sulu Sea, by the way?
Can we pass?
Between Malaysia and the Philippines in the South Pacific.
I guess. Yeah.
It's kind of hard to place without a map.
Down. That narrows it down.
Yeah.
So, third question for Tim. The Caucasus Mountains form most of the border between Russia and what country on the Black Sea?
He's closing his eyes trying to picture it.
Crimea.
I'm sorry, no, it's Georgia.
No, Georgia's in the southeastern United States. That can't be right.
It has to be Tennessee, nearby.
It's right nearby, yeah. It's just south of Florida. So, okay.
By the way, you only have four rounds, right?
We have eight.
Oh, we have eight.
I only have four for you. I'm sorry. In the regular B, there'd be eight.
Oh, okay. Okay. All right. Okay. So are we on our last round?
Yes.
We're
all tied with one.
So these are examples of championship round questions that they would have had. So.
And I can tell you from experience, the championship round questions are tough.
Yeah, you sent a sample of one of the questions,
I did.
And I didn't even understand the question.
Yeah. So.
Much like Villanova, I will be holding a parade later today for my victory.
Maybe a small
He's
one.
He's calling it. So, Scott, Iceland's largest city is located on Faxaflói Bay, or Faxa Bay, and is the center of its cod fishing industry. Name the city.
Okay, I'm going to mispronounce it, but Reykjavik.
It's the only city anyone knows of in Iceland.
Yeah, exactly.
Reykjavik is correct.
See, that's not right.
See, I knew that.
Yeah.
I knew that.
Spell it. Spell it.
R-E-Y. There
wrong
we go.
Already.
I think you're already wrong.
Yeah.
No, R-E-Y is correct.
Oh, that's all right. Well, then.
See?
There's a J in there.
Yeah. R-E-Y, Kvik.
Kvik.
So, all right, so.
It's
2-1,
guys. It is 2-1. So we're going to go overtime if we can tie.
Yeah.
Do you have some overtime questions?
I have an overtime question.
All right.
Good.
The islands of Madura and Bali are part of which country?
Oh, boy.
That is not it.
No, no.
I'm unfamiliar with that country.
Oh,
boy.
Bali. I should know that. I've heard of it.
I'm sure that's what the students say at the B.
Yeah, I've heard of that. Could I have the definition, please? Oh, wait, that's the spelling bee. I'm just going to throw out India.
Indonesia. Would you rather?
I
would have went with India.
You misheard me. I said Indonesia.
I'll go to the ruling of the judges. Is that close enough for no? The judges are saying no.
The child in the corner is laughing at me. That's great for my self-esteem.
How old is your daughter?
9.
And she knows this.
She knew that.
Yeah.
Everybody knows that but Brad.
Well, what's ironic is Indonesia was your last answer.
It was. Yeah.
All right, and our last question here for Tim. The Donets Basin is in an industrial area shared by Russia and which neighboring country to the west?
I'm getting a lot of Russian questions here, so.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Country to the west, Donets Basin. Simply because there was an Admiral Donets in Germany, I'm going to say Germany.
That's incorrect. It's Ukraine.
Right.
And I believe it by 2-1 to 1.
All right, well, let's have the tiebreaker just to...
Yeah, let's have that
tiebreaker just for...
And then I have a question that I'd like to ask.
All right, okay, yes. All right.
If there had been a tie.
There still could be.
That could be. The Taklamakan Desert, home of the Gur people, is located north of the Kunlun Mountains in which Asian country?
All right, you want to do that again?
No. The Taklamakan Desert, home of the Uyghur people, is located north of the Kunlun Mountains in which Asian country?
Oh, I'm glad we didn't get to this one.
Yeah.
We can all three guess at this.
I'm still thinking about it.
It's just picking an Asian country at random at this point.
Well, I'm trying to narrow down language and that kind of thing, what it sounds like. But because I got to tell you that, Darryl, this one here has us completely stumped. This actually is a question that...
It has been, yeah.
It has been. I pity that kid. I pity that moderator had to read that. I'm thinking of this in a different way.
I'm gonna go with Nepal.
Nepal, that's a pass.
Okay. I'm gonna go back to Mongolia.
It was China.
I was close.
The big one.
The big one.
Yeah, the big one. All right. I have a question, and I'm going to give you multiple choices.
This is
more of the style of question that I was hoping for when we came into the studio this morning. The capital of Kentucky is A, Louisville, B, Louisville, C, Frankfort, or D, the K?
C, Frankfort.
That is correct. We would also accept the K, because it is the capital in Kentucky.
The big K.
Yes.
I thought you were going to throw them off with the pronunciation of Louisville.
No, that's a great barb bet, though. You ask somebody if the capital of Kentucky is pronounced Louisville or Louisville, they'll pick one almost every time, and you say, no, it's Frankfort, buy me a beer.
So, you know, I'm curious. You know, we did pretty well with the, we got one right, the three of us.
We got four right.
I know, but
that's
right. I'm saying
four
the
rounds,
first
that's
round.
Right. Overtime.
It's an average of more than one per person.
With... The American students, obviously, they're much more familiar with United States geography. Mm-hmm. But do they still have issues with, are there still some challenges with American cities, American rivers?
You don't see as often in the B students getting the early rounds as many wrong.
Right.
But yeah, there's still questions that are missed and students confuse themselves sometimes. I think often more pressure than anything, they get a little nervous.
So. What do they need to know? I mean, and you guys weigh in on this too, because as news directors, I mean, we're talking about events that are happening around the world. Mm-hmm. What do they need to know?
We always in college, I always try to tell my students, developing a mental map, the ability to put a map out in front of you when you close your eyes and just know where the continents lay out, what countries are in which continents. major regions of those and placing those things on a map on your own, so that it's not just that you're looking them up and pointing at it with your finger, but that you can actually keep them in mind, because then that does give you some ideas of where things are. When you hear something like sending to the border of, you kind of get an idea of where that not only means for that those two countries, but who else may be affected by it.
Would playing the board game Risk have helped me at all today?
Not so much, but it's a good map skills to it, and you know, moving between things. So.
Just ask. Asking for a friend.
Brad Crispin, Tim Lambert, WITS News Directors. Guys, thank you very much for putting yourself out there.
Embarrassing ourselves.
No,
yes.
You did all right.
I got one right. I hang my head high.
Yeah,
you
will.
And Daryl Winter is the co-coordinator for the Pennsylvania State Geography Bee, which will be held at the State Museum tomorrow, coordinator for this year's Geo Challenge. He's professor of geography at Bloomsburg University. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, we'll be talking about the way the state is preparing for self-driving vehicles. PennDOT actually is making some plans for what the highways will look like, or what they should look like, when there are self-driving vehicles out there. We also will be talking about a recent report that pointed out that there is a real problem here in Pennsylvania with the number of babies that are being born addicted to drugs. That's coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, so be sure to tune in.